I'm Georgie Crawford. This is the Gut Glow Podcast. Following a cancer diagnosis in my 30s, my goal is to inspire and empower people on their self-care journey. Through the conversations I have with my guests, we hope to do just that.
There is a plan, and believe that if you're at rock bottom and you're suffering, this is all part of your life, your tapestry. This is your story, and where you go next is what's crucial.
Although I went through a tough time, it showed me how someone could still love me at my lowest and at my weakest, because the love before was easy, but the love at my lowest was real.
So deep down, we all know what we want in life. We all know what makes us happy. We all know the life we dreamed about. And deep down, we all know what we're capable of if you only give yourself permission to do it.
I now live a healthy and fulfilled life where self-care is a top priority, and every day is an opportunity to grow. This season of the Gut Glow Podcast is brought to you with thanks to Ireland's leading pharmacy chain, Lloyds Pharmacy. Do you suffer from allergies or hay fever? Lloyds Pharmacy has a wide range of medicated and non-medicated solutions to give you the relief you need to enjoy the rest of your summer. Visit lloydspharmacy.ie for all your allergy and hay fever needs. Lloyds Pharmacy. Say hello to the people that know. This week on the Gut Glow Podcast, I'm joined by Lottie Bowser. I first came across Lottie a couple of months ago, and I've been following her journey ever since. Lottie and her fiancé Ben lived in London. They were living life to the max. Ben was a music agent. They enjoyed gigs. Ben was fit and healthy. And one day in 2019, Lottie was giving Ben a massage when she felt a lump in his back. They never expected to get a cancer diagnosis, and they were even more shocked when they were told Ben's cancer was terminal. Today, Lottie tells me everything they went through, how they navigated the diagnosis, how they dealt with the shock, and how together they decided to travel to Mexico to try to get life-saving treatment for Ben. Ben was responding well to the treatment, but he contracted COVID-19 and died in Tijuana in 2020. Lottie today tells me how utterly devastated and heartbroken she was. Of course, Lottie is still very newly in grief, and she still has really, really hard days and moments. But today she tells me how she's piecing her life back together, how she is trying her best to lean towards joy and get her sparkle back. And she is so open about everything she goes through on a daily basis. And I think that's why thousands of people have connected with her story. She really is a voice for those dealing with grief. And I'm so grateful to her for coming onto my podcast today. Lottie, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me on the Gut Glow today. I've been waiting for this conversation. I've been following your journey on Instagram. I find you so inspiring. So thank you so much for being a guest today.
Georgie, thank you. That means a lot. It's good to be here.
It's been a very difficult few years for you, Lottie, and you are sharing your journey online now with the hope of helping others. Mm-hmm. Something you said the other day really struck me was when you said, no feeling is final. Mm. And mm-hmm. you're certainly wearing your heart on your sleeve at the moment as you share everything that you're going through. But I wanted, with your permission, to talk a little bit about your life with Ben and what sort of person he was, because absolutely. I've seen the videos. It looks like you were absolute soulmates, and it seems like he never stopped smiling.
Without a doubt, yeah, he was and is magic, and yeah, I'm more than happy to talk about him. You know, if anyone gives me the opportunity to, I'll talk until I'm blue in the face. Yeah, Ben and I, wow, we met in 2014, one summer. I wasn't looking for it at all, which I think is often the way that it happens. I just ended up downloading this dating app after recently coming out of a horrific relationship. And he was the second date, I think, that I had on this particular app. And it was just instant fireworks, you know. The moment we met, it was like, okay, this is my person. undone. Wow. Yeah, and things moved really, really quickly. Within 4 weeks, we told each other we loved each other. Within a few months, we were living together because we lived on opposite ends of the city. We both lived in London, and we were essentially spending like 5 or 6 nights out of 7 together. Wow. And we were like, we'd probably save ourselves a little bit of rent if we just moved into the same place. And we were pretty much inseparable from that moment. I think, you know, when you know, you know. Mm. And there is no such thing as you know, a kind of linear time frame that you need to stick to, I think, when you have met the person you want to spend the rest of your life with. And, you know, Ben did spend the rest of his life with me. We were together for 6 magical years, traveling the world, dancing across the earth, basically. He was a music agent, so that was an incredible job that took us to all corners of the globe, having these incredible experiences together. That was kind of our shared passion. And it was magic. I could not fault our relationship. I could not fault him as a human being. And a lot of people will say that I'm biased, of course. But you ask pretty much anyone that crossed paths with Ben and they will say the same thing. He was literally like this angel, you know, this real life angel to have walked the earth, and just a really beautiful person. It was like his bones were good, you know, just the walking embodiment of love and light. And his mission was to just, you know, make a positive difference, to help people no matter what shape or form that took. And he really did have an enormous impact, albeit, you know, a short life. It was very meaningful.
Because in those videos that you share of Ben, he's always dancing, always smiling. Like that energy that you're speaking about comes out. And I found myself smiling watching the videos. Mm-hmm. It's like his energy was infectious.
Completely. He was such a magnetic person. And the thing is, he didn't have to try. He just always was the center of attention. You know, like everyone would gravitate towards him. He always had this like beautiful aura and presence, and very much a yes man. An incredible person to be around. And genuinely, Georgie, I would thank my lucky stars every single day to wake up next to him. I'd often wake up before him and be like, shit, like how did I get so lucky to end up with this incredible, perfect human being, you know, physically, spiritually, intellectually, mentally, emotionally. He was just a flawless human being.
And so tell us about Ben's diagnosis. Did he feel unwell?
No, he didn't. And this, I think, has been one of the toughest pills to swallow in the wake of everything that's happened, because Ben was the healthiest, most vibrant, most vivacious person. He trained in martial arts 5 times a week minimum. He ate organic food. He would dabble in fasting and, you know, cold water exposure, heat therapy, all this kind of stuff. Really, really healthy, strong person. In fact, I would often feel envious because he just never felt ill. We could be, you know, sharing the same bed and I would be coughing and spluttering all over his face and he would be completely fine. He was never that person to get ill. He had an amazing immune system. And I think it was the start of 2019, I was actually giving him a massage at the time, and I noticed a lump in his back between his shoulder blade and his spine. And I remember really going to town on this lump, like kneading it, pressing it, getting my elbow in there. He couldn't feel anything. There was no pain. And because he was a martial artist, he did a lot of jiu-jitsu. He often dislocated his shoulder. And he dislocated it a few months prior, and we thought perhaps it's just like a buildup of tissue, you know, the muscles healed itself weirdly and it's created this strange kind of round shape. And of course you don't think a lump in the back would be a malignant tumor. We didn't really think anything of it. But after some time, it didn't go away. He took some time off of, martial arts. He took some time off of exercise in general, and it didn't subside. So he ended up going to the doctors they kind of brushed it off. They said it's probably a lipoma, nothing to worry about, but, you know, we'll book you in for an ultrasound. And that happened 6 weeks later. And I think that then took us to middle of June 2019. And as soon as he had that ultrasound, very quickly the lady doing it, you know, Ben felt that something wasn't right, and he was fast-tracked through this kind of diagnostic process. And a couple of weeks later, actually was less than a week after we got back from Glastonbury Festival, which was like the last normal, you know, pre-cancer experience we had together before everything went south. He was diagnosed with a malignant peripheral nerve sheath tumor, which neither of us had ever heard before. It's a type of soft tissue sarcoma, and I think it accounts for 0.05% of all sarcoma diagnoses. And then sarcoma, as a particular type of cancer, I think accounts for less than 5% of all cancers. So it is extremely rare. Very, very difficult to treat because there are simply no, you know, there's not enough funding. There aren't enough people being diagnosed with this particular type of cancer. So there really aren't that many treatment options available besides surgery, radiotherapy, chemotherapy. And so that's kind of when that journey, which is essentially now looking back on it, the beginning of the end, began.
Wow. And what a shock, you know, just to land on your doorstep in the middle of your gorgeous life. Mm-hmm. You know, this beautiful, healthy man, mm-hmm. to get something like this. What was his reaction to it? How did he face it?
We were both utterly devastated. I remember distinctly sat on the grass outside of Stanmore Hospital, having just received this news and sharing it with our families and just being at a complete loss. It was so shocking. And the whole way through this process, granted it had only been a few weeks, but we'd seen various clinicians and oncologists, etc., beforehand. They were like, it's highly unlikely it's going to be anything serious. Do not worry. You know, it really doesn't look like it's going to be malignant or cancerous. So it was like this bomb.
That's such a shock.
Such a shock. And Ben, of all people to get it, you know, I can think of dozens more people who are far less healthy than him that would be a more obvious victim of a diagnosis like this. But I've since realized it doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. Cancer doesn't work like that. It's indiscriminate, you know?
Yeah. Healthy people get cancer.
Yeah. It has nothing to do with how healthy you are. And that's been a huge thing for me. It's like all of my belief systems around the human body, what is and is not possible, you know, how much control we have over our health, have been completely flipped upside down.
Were you strong during those days? What did the doctors say to you about this diagnosis?
So with the first diagnosis, when it was just the lump in his back, they offered a treatment pathway that involved surgery. If the surgery went well, then Ben would then go on to do radiotherapy, which would essentially just be like a kind of insurance policy, like a preventative measure. Mm-hmm. And the hope was that doing both of those treatments would mean Ben would be cancer-free and we could move forwards. And we often joked, you know, this will just be that summer where we look back and remember, you know, say to ourselves, do you remember when you got cancer? Like how random and how incredible that we've moved through it. So we did all of that. He had the surgery. They got really clear margins. He did radiotherapy for 6 weeks. He was jogging and training for the marathon the following year. During that time, his intention was to raise money for the sarcoma charity, Sarcoma UK. And we had an incredible holiday at the end of that year in Australia. And he proposed, which was completely unexpected, a couple of seconds before midnight struck on New Year's Eve. We were overlooking Sydney Harbour Bridge with our best friends. And then all was fine and dandy. You know, he had checkups planned, and we celebrated his 36th birthday 2 weeks into lockdown in March. And then the day after, we had a follow-up scan at Stanmore. So we took the car, we drove outside of London to that appointment. And it was when the doctors said, we're going to run another test. We're going to do another scan on you because we've seen something and we're not too sure what it is. That's when, you know, shit started to feel very, very scary. And those 15, 20 minutes, whatever it was between, you know, having that second scan and hearing the news, it's terminal, felt like they'd lasted a lifetime. It was utterly hell, you know, hellish, just unbelievable.
Did you get that news that day?
Yeah.
The same day,
the day after his 36th birthday, it's terminal. And the oncologist said, you know, we don't know how long you will have. We can offer you treatment in the hope that it will manage the growth of the disease, but it's in the lungs and this cancer will kill you.
I'm so sorry. Mm. It's when you just think that that will never happen to you. I don't know if, did you feel like you're on the outside looking in at a movie or something that wasn't your life?
Completely. And to be honest, Georgie, it's been that way up until very recently. You know, I've felt like I am witnessing the unfolding of a movie that just is not my life.
Yeah.
And there are no words to describe how immensely painful and terrifying a situation like that is. And you have no control, you know.
Mm.
It just didn't make any sense to either of us. And, you know, the first days and weeks after that news were incredibly dark. But then we quickly turned things around and we were really, really intent on him being, you know, that success story, because there are success stories.
Yes.
You know, you are one of them. And we poured all of our time, resources, energy and money into, you know, trying to find a solution that would enable him to reverse the disease.
So that is that at the point where you looked outside of the UK for treatment options?
So we didn't start looking until about the middle of summer, perhaps this time last year, actually July last year, because the NHS suggested Ben have lung surgery.
Okay.
That was going to give him the best chance of survival, removing some of, if not all of the tumours in the lungs. When they actually went in there, they saw more disease than what was showing on the scan. So they couldn't do a full resection of the cancer. It was a partial resection. And then they offered a particular type of chemotherapy that is often offered to MP and ST patients. It's like a really standard run-of-the-mill chemo. It didn't have much chance of efficacy, but mm-hmm. we thought, let's try it anyway. Let's see if it buys us some time. You know, you've had the resection, some cancerous tissue is now out. So hopefully that would mean we're gaining time.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And in the midst of all of that, we were doing other things. We literally threw the kitchen sink at it. Like, you know, you name it, we did it. The THC oil, the CBD oil, the repurposed medicines, you know, that are off the shelf medicines known to, you know, shrink tumors
mm-hmm.
and reverse the cancering process. Coffee enemas, water enemas, fasting, meditation, visualization, therapy, you know, saunas, everything, nothing helped. This thing was like wildfire. It just spread rapidly. And, you know, a few cycles of chemotherapy, we found out it wasn't working. And it was end of August that we made the decision to go abroad. We found out about an alternative treatment center that a lot of people were having success with in Mexico. So, you know, we upped sticks, we packed our bags, we flew to Mexico. And by that point, Ben was Ben was really compromised. You know, the chemo that he was on was one of the most aggressive chemotherapy regimens going. I think a lot of people outside of, you know, the cancer experience don't realize that there are hundreds of different chemo drugs, you know, that it's not a kind of one size fits all situation. So some people thrive and can go about their everyday life on chemotherapy, whereas for Ben, it was a completely different kettle of fish. You know, he was in and out of hospital with infections and completely incapacitated. And bearing in mind, we're in a lockdown. Ben and I have been isolating now for 5 months because he was incredibly vulnerable. Obviously, the cancer was in his lungs. In the end, it is actually COVID, you know, that resulted in his hospitalization and his passing. But this has just been the summer of hell, you know, up until this point. And this was essentially the last roll of the dice, you know.
Yes. And how were you, just in terms of your own mental health and how you were, and this was so much for you to deal with. How did you cope?
You know what? I have no idea. I have no idea. Looking back on it, I cannot believe I'm still here to tell the tale. I felt as though I was constantly white knuckling it on the scariest, most tumultuous, most unpredictable roller coaster ride ever. And the thing is, there is no emergency stop button. You cannot get off it. You are just racing towards this imminent possibility of death. And no matter how much you try, no matter how much research you do, no matter how many sleepless nights you endure, no matter how much you pray and wish and meditate and visualize and do all of the things, you know, nothing is working, nothing is helping, and you feel completely out of control. And, you know, usually when somebody is experiencing something like a cancer diagnosis, you've got a whole village, right? You've got people coming to help carry that person and their caregiver or caregivers, whereas I was essentially having to do it alone because it was really important that Ben was shielded from the virus. And it was morning to night, you know, and sometimes it would trickle over into the night because you are worried that, you know, your partner's stopped breathing, you're checking their temperature whilst they're asleep, you're dealing with your own demons and own anxieties that come up, you know, in the dark. And it was just constant. And I felt like I was drowning. I felt like I was struggling to keep my head above water every single minute of the day. And there were moments where I would just break down, you know, I'd have to close the door behind Ben and sob, you know, into the phone whilst having a conversation with my mum. You just feel utterly helpless. Utterly, utterly helpless.
Did he verbalize how much your care meant to him?
He did. He did. You know, things changed in terms of the dynamic between us towards the end of his life, I think. You know, he was grappling with pain and the side effects of his treatment. But he did. Yeah, he did. I know that he was grateful. And Georgie, I would do it all over again in a heartbeat. You know, I would do it for 50 years straight if it meant that Ben was still here. You know, I really would. It's like there are no limits to what you would do, you know, to try and keep the person you love most in the world alive, you know?
I can't even imagine going through that during COVID. Just feels cruel.
It was just unbelievably cruel. And, you know, I often think about Ben's final months. He didn't have the opportunity to see any of his friends or his family particularly. You know, there was no semblance of normality for him, and that's all you would want for somebody, you know, reaching the kind of final stages of their life.
Yeah, because one of the last posts that he wrote on Instagram was this great news that you got in Mexico about the treatment and that it was working.
Yeah,
what was your time in Mexico like?
You know what, Georgie? I have tried to find solace in this idea that Ben felt as though and believed that he was healing his cancer. You know, that he didn't pass with all hope lost. You know, he still felt hopeful and he still felt excited about, you know, the prospect of a long, happy future cancer-free. It was really difficult because, again, you know, Ben and I went there alone. I was his only physical caregiver. We were obviously in a foreign country. And it was an impossible responsibility. As I said, I would do it all over again. You know, no hesitation at all, completely willing. I can't think of a more important role, you know, that I could play in my lifetime for somebody. But it was so difficult. It was so difficult.
How long were you there for?
Well, we were there for about 5 weeks. And then around 4 to 5 weeks into treatment, because Ben had some time in between his cycles, his program at the center, he caught COVID, and it was only after he was medically induced, he was put into a coma on a ventilator, did we discover that both him and I tested positive for the virus. So we had a week prior to that, prior to him going unconscious, where neither of us felt particularly well, but you don't put two and two together because you're on the other side of the world. You're not really paying attention to the news. You are in this bubble of cancer and treatment and healing. You're not really thinking about the other risks. You know, if we felt so far removed from the virus at that point, mm-hmm. and cases at the time in Tijuana, which is where the center was, were really, really low. So we didn't think much of it, and we kind of felt secure in, you know, the bubble of the center and the community of friends and other patients that were there. So I didn't pick up on the warning signs, you know, and there's been immense guilt over that for me. But it all spiraled downhill over the course of about 24 hours, where Ben's cough was becoming really quite bad. He had to stay overnight in the center with oxygen support. And then I ended up actually sharing the room with him. I stayed with him one night, and he had, you know, an oxygen mask on that evening. And the following morning, I obviously hadn't slept a wink by that point. Suddenly his oxygen saturation levels began plummeting, and they were at 90, they were at 80. Just to give your listeners some context, anything below 90 is considered a medical emergency, a real cause for concern.
Okay.
And there were doctors kind of coming and going in that center, but it wasn't a hospital. So they couldn't provide, you know, emergency ventilation or something. This was beyond their scope of expertise. Mm. So we then had to wait for an ambulance to come. But by that point, I'm on another planet. I've got no idea what's gone on. I'm completely delirious from the lack of sleep over the last week. Suddenly there's panic in the room. You know, Ben is really struggling. And the oxygen saturation levels are at 80, then suddenly 70, then 60. Now they're at 50, and, you know, the paramedics have come. He's being put onto a stretcher, and I'm sort of faffing with the manager of the hospital to try and make a payment in order to allow Ben to be admitted. They needed $10,000 straight away in order to actually accept him as an inpatient. And, everything unfolded within the space of 5 minutes. Suddenly we were in an ambulance, you know, hurtling along the motorway. And when we arrived at the hospital, they prevented me from going in. So mine and Ben's final moments together were me being physically restrained from entering, and him with so much panic in his eyes, just being rushed through on the stretcher. And the last thing that I heard him hear, heard him say, was, my name. And then he was intubated. And that was that. And he never woke up. He was intubated that morning, and he was in a very, very critical condition. And the day before, you know, we were celebrating our 7-year anniversary in the hospital room with a takeaway.
Oh, God. Lottie.
Sorry. God. I don't think I've revisited, you know, those months and those weeks and that day for some time. And I certainly haven't talked about it.
It's very hard to context. It's different when you're saying it out loud, because you remember it all in your head and in your mind and in your dreams and in every part of you, but actually saying it out loud is different, isn't it?
It's so different. And I think, you know, what I've probably done is pushed it to the back of my mind, you know, into the deepest kind of darkest recesses of my consciousness, just so that I can continue to survive and to exist. And yeah, it's a process of catharsis, though.
Yeah,
you know, in sharing it.
But going to Mexico, he got that hope. I don't know. It came across like he had hope, and I know you touched on that a few minutes ago. Do you think deep down it was good for him around that time to feel that?
Definitely. And, you know, something that I have needed to do in order to process what happened to Ben is to, particularly in the first few weeks and months, was to scour every email correspondence, every Skype conversation that was recorded, to just try and piece together, you know, this situation and this outcome, to understand how we got, you know, to that place after having so much hope. Because I refused to believe that Ben wasn't going to survive, you know. I could not allow myself to go there. It was just too painful, too unbearable to even contemplate a future without him. So I've had a number of conversations with Ben's oncology team since in London, and, you know, the sad reality, the devastating reality, is that, you know, Ben was very unlikely to survive regardless, you know, even if COVID hadn't come along and led to him being intubated and then dealing with all of these other complications, you know, whilst he was on that ventilator in ICU over the course of those weeks. It's very unlikely that he would have overcome his disease. It was just that aggressive.
And were you alone at this point, Lottie?
I was very, very fortunate to have one of my best friends, Jazz, with me at the time.
Okay.
But he was on a ventilator for 24 days, and every day it was, you know, he's critical again, he's stable again, O2 saturation levels have gone up, they've come down, we're doing this, there might be this implication. It was just a constant roller coaster. We never knew what was coming next. And sometimes there would be 30 hours, you know, between this one phone call that you got a day from the ICU team. And we were actually sat in a restaurant one afternoon. We just ordered a load of food, and suddenly the doctor called and said, Lottie, if you can, you need to come to the hospital because we think that Ben might go into cardiac arrest soon. And it was as though, I remember my body just shaking uncontrollably, it was like a somatic earthquake just full body shudders at that point. You know, the trauma of that news was just, it's indescribable. And we got there after he passed, a few minutes after he passed. And, you know, the experience of having to step into a COVID-specific ICU ward, head to toe in a hazmat suit, in the gloves, you know, the latex gloves, the mask, the goggles, the hairnet, etc., and to touch, to not be able to touch the skin, you know, of your loved one who's passed. You can only touch through these gloves. It's just utterly horrific, you know. And this is not unique, you know, this experience that I've had is not unique. There are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, of course, you know, given the global death rate, millions of people who have experienced something similar, you know, this past year and a half.
And how did you hold yourself back from ripping it all off?
I mean, I did rip a glove off in the end.
Did you?
Yeah, I did, because I just needed to.
Yeah. It's inhumane not to touch your soulmate.
It's inhumane, but, you know, the environment just did not allow for staying around, you know. It was all too clinical and medical and space-like and horrific to want to sit and process what had happened. I was actually on the phone to one of my best friends, Annie, at the time. I have no recollection of this conversation whatsoever. She only told me a few months ago, actually, that she was talking to me as I was with Ben for the last time in the physical sense. I needed to get out. You know, I needed to get out after, you know, some time had passed. And I remember Jazz and I, you know, walking through those hospital doors and me just saying moment by moment, moment by moment, this is all I can think of, literally one foot in front of the other, left, right, left, right. Let's get in a taxi and get back to the hotel. And then we'll just take stock of what just happened.
So what did you do next?
So the next steps were to try and repatriate Ben. And suddenly you're having to think about funeral arrangements, transportation arrangements, you know, and I'm just trying to wrap my head around what's actually happened, the fact that he's no longer alive, and then having to deal with liaising with funeral directors on top of that. You know, this is the crazy thing. There's no time to wrap your head around this utterly world-shattering experience that you've just gone through, before all of the horrific administrative responsibilities that come with death, you know, start, like, you know, unfolding. So, you know, I was out there for another 2 weeks after he passed. I had no choice but to stay in Mexico to try and sort out his cremation, his repatriation. And so, you know, it was 2 weeks after he died that I eventually got myself back to England. You know, and this was, yeah, I think by that point, around 2 months after having left the UK, end of August.
So that was the coming towards the end of 2020 then, was
it? Yeah, it was the 1st of December that I arrived back. My mum and stepdad picked me up from the airport and I went straight back there. I could not face my flat. You know, Ben and I owned a flat in London together. I couldn't go back there at that point. And we were just heading into another lockdown as well. And I didn't want to be alone. You know, I spent the next 4 months in isolation with my mum and stepdad, who were considered vulnerable. So, you know, by that point, the vaccine hadn't been rolled out, hadn't been offered to them. So I still needed to shield in order to protect them. But yeah, I went back there and just, you know, stayed in bed for a few weeks and threw myself into writing and journaling and connecting with other grieving people online, because, you know, I wasn't able to see any of my friends, who weren't able to do any of the normal rituals, you know, surrounding death that you would want to do. Mm-hmm. We did have a small funeral, but that was limited to 30 people, and then people tuned in via Zoom. But yeah, it's so weird, Georgie, recounting it, because it feels like a lifetime ago, but also a second ago in the same breath.
Yeah. Do you feel different each morning?
Definitely.
How are you? Are the bad days less frequent as you move through this? How are you feeling at the moment?
If somebody had said this to me 8 months ago, day one after Ben died, I wouldn't have believed them. But it does change as time passes. It's not that it gets easier. I think that we just get better at carrying it. And it's, you know, time is a weird thing in grief as well, because, you know, there were days where I was like, I don't want to feel such intense pain. You know, it was all consuming. It was mind, body, soul pain. You know, there were days where I actually felt I was going to die because the pain, the physical pain was so intense. But it has changed, you know, it ebbs and it flows, and the waves of grief, when they hit me, they are just as intense as day one, but I have a bit more space. I can breathe a bit deeper. I can smile. I can laugh, and I can go periods of time without being consumed by my grief or consumed by my thoughts of Ben. And that's weird unto itself. You know, it's like you then are grappling with feelings of guilt because you haven't really thought about it today. You haven't cried today. But actually, you know, we have to grant ourselves some grace. Like, it's impossible to be grieving and in pain, you know, 24/7, 100% of the time. Let's seize those lighter moments, you know, yes, and be grateful for them. It doesn't mean that it's not there. But, you know, we are deserving of some respite.
You recently traveled with a friend. Mm. Were you in Portugal?
I was in Portugal, and then I hopped over to Ibiza because my other best friend couldn't come out to be with me for my final week. And I thought, well, rather than cutting my holiday short, you know, I'm feeling really good. I'm going to continue following the thread of joy and just extend my holiday. So yeah, I was away for 3 weeks, and it was the happiest time for me. I felt completely renewed and re-inspired, and, you know, for the first time in a long, long time, actually hopeful again, you know, dare I say it, for my future.
That is so good to hear. And yeah. What do you think it was about those weeks away that got you to that place?
I think for me, it was stepping away from the environment that I shared with Ben, from the environment that I had been in throughout my grief up until that point, and just being in a new place, you know, with a new energy, with a new community, with new faces, and preoccupying myself with new experiences, you know, discovering a new place and just getting myself in the sunshine and immersed in nature. It was just it was such a balm. It was like such a medicine for me.
What have you learned? What have you learned about yourself this year? I mean,
oh Jesus.
like what you said, you know, you thought you were going to die. Like, how on earth could you survive something like that? Mm-hmm. You know, how could you not die of a broken heart? Oh. How do you, so when you look back at, have you changed, or are you there yet?
How can you live with somebody you never thought you could live without? Mm. You know, and here I am 8 months later, still living, right? I'm doing it. I'm doing this seemingly impossible, something I never could have imagined being able to do. And it's because of that, it's been this enormous journey of self-love. Like, my God, you know, if I didn't love myself before, which I didn't, I really do now, you know. I, as much as your support system, your friends and your family are there, you know, they are on this journey with you, you kind of are alone in your grief, because there is nobody else on the planet that understands what it feels like to be Ben's partner, right? I was the only person who was fortunate enough to play that role in his life. And, you know, that realization, like, shit, I actually am on my own in some ways, and I have to rely on me. You know, I have to find the strength within me to carry this and find a way of moving forwards with this. And there were many a dark moment where I felt like tapping out. You know, suicidal ideation in grief is very, very real, and it's not spoken about enough. There were days where I woke up and I wish I hadn't, you know, but I felt at that point it wouldn't be right for me to cause additional pain, you know, on the people that love me. So I had to find a way of carrying my own. And it's made me realize that, you know, as human beings, we have limitless capacity to carry the seemingly impossible, you know, the resilience that we have to overcome things. And I've said to each of my friends, I really hope that what I've been through and the way that I have moved through my grief and integrated my grief over the last 8 months, I hope it shows you that, you know, no matter what happens, breakups, divorces, tragedies, whatever life throws at us, you know, we are going to be okay. You know, and I didn't think that I would be, but now I know that I can and I will be.
Wow, that's powerful. Like what we said, you know, no feeling is final.
No feeling is final.
And we're on a journey through life. Every day is different.
Every day is different, exactly. And that quote, I can't remember the author now, the lady that wrote No Feeling is Final in her book, you know, that's been something that I've held on to throughout, you know, the last 8 months. And I think what's helped me to get to this point, you know, in my grief is holding out for better days, surrounding myself with a really incredible support system of friends, equipping myself with resources, therapy, counseling, yoga, meditation, all of this kind of stuff, various body-based practices, and also delving into the concepts surrounding the afterlife, the other side, really deepening my spirituality and my connection to Ben, because, you know, I don't believe that death is the end, and that is something that's really, really supported me.
Do you ask for signs?
I do.
Do you get them?
He gives me a lot of them. So music, as I mentioned earlier, was our main passion. Ben was in that industry since he left uni, and I often hear really obscure songs, not just even, you know, some of our favorite well-known songs playing just at the right time, or, you know, there'll be things in nature that pop up that I feel are, you know, little winks from him. And, you know, I'd encourage anybody who is in the midst of grief to be open to this stuff, because it is real.
Do you look to the future, Lottie, or are you taking it each day at a time?
I do look to the future, and I'm doing various things to honour Ben. I'm in the process of establishing a non-profit in his memory. I'm in the process of actually writing a workbook on grief to support my grief community. And these are all things that get me up in the morning, that make me feel excited about the future. And it's a way for me to carry Ben with me. You know, as time passes, Ben will always be at the heart of what I do. And I'm going to be shouting about that man until I join him.
Well, please keep sharing the videos of him and all of your gorgeous memories, because they make people happy, you know, seeing him the way he was. He was such a gift to those around him. And then by you sharing those videos, you're continuing on that he's a gift to us when we watch those videos,
totally,
you know.
Totally, totally. As I said, you know, death ends a life, but, you know, that person's legacy can be carried forwards, whether it's just, you know, it could be in the form of a charity initiative. It could be in the form of simply carrying, you know, that person who's passed values and, you know, best attributes with you as you move forwards. And let's talk about them. Let's shout about the people that have transitioned. You know, they deserve to be celebrated. Mm-hmm. They don't deserve to be kind of stuck in the past. And I think there's something really healing and really therapeutic in that.
You're doing such an amazing job, and thank you for sharing your story with me today. I'm really enjoying following your page, and thank you for helping me understand and educating me as well in grief. It's so helpful. So keep doing your amazing work. You're incredible.
Oh, so are you. Thank you so much, my love. It's just been an honor to talk to, to have this opportunity to celebrate Ben and to hopefully offer some guidance and support to other people going through it.
Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast, with thanks to Lloyd's Pharmacy. The Good Glow wellness program is now online, based around my pillars of self-care. This online course is a guide to better holistic health. For a limited time, the course is down from 85 to 69 euro, and you can head over to thegoodglow.ie for more information. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate and review, and I'll see you next week.